Committee on Commerce. We're going to start our proceeding. We have three bills today. Due to the desired participation on the first two, we're going to start off with the last one, Senate Bill 713. And since Senator Cruz is here, we'll let him start off since he's the proponent, supporter of the bill. Senate Bill 713, open for a public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am State Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Thank you for the hearing on this bill. It came to a degree somewhat as a surprise. Let me tell you the
surprise.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'm a freshman senator, so everything here surprises me. The genesis of this bill is wondering why I can't know what I'm paying when I go into a cardlock station for the fuel I'm buying. This never used to be an issue for us because back before they decided to go to two grades of diesel, we would just fill up everything out of the one tank we have on the farm. When they went to two grades of diesel, the majority of the diesel we use is off-road diesel, the high sulfur diesel, and so that's what's in our big tank. But it becomes a problem for us. It became a problem for us because, amazingly, in some small towns, you don't have a whole lot of 24-hour gas stations and none that are necessarily handy, and we had a card lock that was. And due to the nature of our business, sometimes we don't run an 8 in the morning to 5 o'clock business. And then in talking with some other folks who use this sort of system, and I said, don't you ever wonder why we don't know what we're paying? And they said, yeah, that doesn't make sense. And I said, well, maybe we ought to have them post their prices. And they said, yeah, why don't you do that? So I did that. And I've talked to, there's some folks that may not be overly thrilled with this idea. And honestly, Mr. Chair, I don't know probably everything about the system. There may be valid reasons why not. I know that some of the larger outfits sign contracts month at a time or whatever with the retailer, and so they would know their price. I have a feeling that a lot of the smaller outfits don't, and I would just like some sort of way, some sort of notification, even if it's when you swipe your card and you punch in what it is, you know, whether you're getting diesel or premium or whatever you're getting, that maybe there's some way that a unit price can come up so you had an idea of what you were paying. It's just, for me, I just think it makes sense that I know what I'm paying when I pull in someplace to get fuel. It's no more complicated than that from my perspective. Mr. Romaine may have some other ideas. I'd certainly be willing to work with him to come up with a solution to what is not the most overwhelming problem the state's facing, but certainly it's a matter of consumer information, and that's the genesis of the bill.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Senator Cruz? All right, and I have already caused a problem, I know, because I didn't ask counsel to talk about what the bill stands for. Should we put anything on the record at this point? Or?
Probably a good idea.
Then why don't you help me out there?
Senate Bill 713 requires a non-retail dealer of motor vehicle fuel to display sign visible from the street on the lowest unit price available for the non-retail fuel. Requires disclosure of conditions on price and consistency between the sign and the unit of measurement of the fuel. Violation of this requirement is a Class C misdemeanor.
Hmm.
And we have what a Class C misdemeanor is. It's $1,250 fine or 30 days imprisonment up to. We have received today a minimal impact from legislative fiscal office.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, the fine and the penalty were not my idea. Obviously something legislative council thought should go in. And also for the record, this was not targeted at the wholesale outlets, just specifically retail, which it says, but there may be some confusion in languages to the scope.
Okay.
But as far as the 30 days in prison, that seems a little excessive to me, but
Don't worry, it's just jail. It's not prison.
Oh, well, that's...
the local facility.
Okay, well, then we have 1149 issues, but that's a whole nother... But that, you know, I'm not tied to any of that. That was a surprise when I saw the bill.
Okay, I mean, yeah, it sounds to me that if you were going to have some type of sanction, it would be on a civil basis based on whatever they did as compared to being in the criminal arena.
Right, right.
Fair enough. If you want to stay up there, Senator Cruz, feel free to do so.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're in health, excuse me, in health and human resources. We're going over an expansion of the bulk purchasing program. I think I should be over there. So I appreciate you giving me the time, and I'll certainly be willing to work with Paul or whoever else if there's a way we can move this.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Mr. Romaine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Petroleum Association. Let me first point out that this deals with non-retail. It's not retail sales. It's your card lock system. Those are systems that are designed for a number of reasons, but it's a negotiated contractual arrangement that usually is done for convenience. Somebody wants a central bill, they've got many people on one account, they basically want to run it through one system. Most of those contracts have prices negotiated into them, and they're usually a whatever pennies above whatever the rack price is or something along those lines. So you sort of know what you're paying, it just depends what the price is. Most of them are done on volume. People that buy a lot will be paying less than people that buy a little. It's a business arrangement. Now, if you wanted to change the entire system and go to self-service, which is kind of a bad word in the state, then you might want to talk about some of these issues. But again, not wanting to face a divorce in my family, I'm not bringing up that issue. But this is it's not the kind of thing where the average person on the street who's shopping for gas will look to see what they're going to pay. The only people who can use it are those, or legitimately use it, are those who have or belong to a business that has negotiated basically a deal one way or another. So that's why you have the system. To display the price would almost be impossible because it depends. It depends who you are when you're coming in. So the price to you, Mr. Chair, might be different than the price to Senator Beyer. In addition, with the different kinds of fuel, used to be a little problem that you see there's different color diesel out there. Some's used farm use. It's exempt from the tax. Street use is not. What you don't want is people to be taking their farm use diesel, putting in a street use car. So that's one of the situations. We'd be happy to talk with Senator Cruz. I think this arises out of a bit of confusion. Oregon's gas system tends to be a little bit confusing to the average consumer out there, but the bottom line is this is not a retail sale to the average customer. It literally, to post a price, you could have 30 different prices that you'd have to post because there's a lot of different deals out there. So thank you. I'd be happy to attempt to answer any questions. There are actually people in the back of the room who really could answer questions if you have any real ones.
Senator Wissett.
Mr. Romaine, can you give us some idea of what kind of a fiscal impact that would have on your providers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, I'm not sure exactly the amount of... It really depends how many contracts they have out there and what price levels they might have. If you have, you know, it's almost impossible to tell somebody because it may be that your contract says that if you buy 10,000 gallons a month, you're going to pay, we'll bill you at X, the rack price plus 15 cents. And if you buy 20,000 gallons a month, we'll bill you at the rack price plus whatever. So when you buy that gas, you don't know exactly what it's going to be. So I'm not sure we would be capable of actually posting the prices in these kind of situations, because it all depends.
It certainly would be a conundrum, because it's not uncommon if you're driving across country. I mean, there's even one trip I know that I purchased fuel from Pacific Pride in four different states, all on the same credit card, all from all different prices, and so I suppose you would have to put a price plus 5% or price plus, it would be a frightful thing to have to do. I can't imagine how you could do it.
Right. Yeah. And Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, if somebody doesn't like the card lock system and they want to purchase where the price is very visible, we do have a fairly significant retail gasoline and diesel fuel system out there, and you're more than welcome to go ahead and do it. If you don't like this particular system, if it doesn't provide the convenience, don't use it.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Paul, Senator Cruz mentioned or asked about, because most of these outfits are now swipe a card, put in a PIN number, and whether or not it would be possible to program the system to display what your price is at that point in time. So you're not displaying it. Each person, each card would have their own code in it, which they do. Is that a feasible option?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I would have to consult with people who actually operate these things, but I'll give you, again, the scenario of what if it's a volume-based discount based on how many gallons you purchase that month. So how detailed do you want this thing to say? It's $1.99 today because you've only purchased, your company's only up to 5,000 gallons, but if by tomorrow they get up to 10,000, then it'll be $1.89 or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of different variables that may go into the particular price you have. And so I suppose in today's technology, anything's possible. It's just how elaborate you have to be.
Well, I guess, you mentioned that everybody's got a contract with these the different retail outlets. Well, as a business owner that has a card lock capability for three different companies, none of them offer me a contract to tell me what the price is going to be. So I pay the bill when it comes to the end of the month, not knowing if it's cost plus 15 cents or cost plus 10 cents or cost plus. There's no volume, no nothing. So I apparently am a small fish, and I know I'm a small fish. But
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, you could ask the company when you sign that contract, what is the price? Is that part of the contract? Does that contract just say you agree to whatever price they're going to charge out there?
That's what my contract has been. They're going to send me a bill, and I'm going to use them, and I recognize it's a convenience issue.
Right.
But
most of those situations. It's a convenience.
But I guess for that kind of a customer who's paying whatever the standard is, whatever I am or whatever Senator Cruz is, when you swipe the card, if it came up, base cost is X, and there may be discounts, but I'm just asking the questions.
Yeah. Again, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I would have to ask some people back there who actually operate these things. I'm merely the lobbyist.
Any other questions?
Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 713? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on 713, and we're going to open up a joint hearing on the two remaining bills. I'll go ahead and open up a public hearing for Senate Bills 738 and Senate Bill 931. And Council, once you go ahead and read.
Senate Bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bills 931 and 738 basically do the same thing. There's some differences in words. We did get a late amendment request to put what's in Senate Bill 931 into Senate Bill 738, so they will be one bill. They basically create standards for fire-safe cigarettes and require all cigarettes sold in Oregon to be fire safe. And they provide for penalties, and it contains an emergency clause.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just for the record, I was given a letter and asked to distribute, and I think it has been, I'm not sure, from the, it's the CAGRO, Korean American Grocery Association. They weren't able to be here, but they wanted to make sure their letter got entered into the record. So I think, hopefully everyone's got one at the dais.
I have one.
Yeah, mine was on the dais underneath.
Yes, okay. We all got it.
Okay.
And then that.
All right, so, Council, just to make sure I understand, it sounds like, based on the request you've got, there may be some amendments out there that would basically fold 931 into 738?
Yes.
All right, well, we're going to take testimony on both. I'm looking at the list. It appears that we have virtually everyone that has signed on to one sheet has signed on the other. So I'm going to start off just going off the names that are on 738. I have noticed that there's one person who is here that's more than 100 miles away, and looks like we got a pretty good split of fours and against. So what I'm going to do is start with the proponents of the bill. I've got Tim Burr, Tom Whelan, and is it Andrew McGuire, excuse me. Why don't y'all come forward first, and we'll let you make your presentation, and then we'll pick up from there. And I apologize, Mr. McGuire, for not pronouncing your name correct. And I'm just going to, gentlemen, before we get started, I do have one other person here that is set as a proponent, Nancy Orr. She's with the State Fire Marshal's Office. Is she part of your presentation, or is she separate? I can bring her up separate. I just
would probably, but yeah, she's
okay.
An independent official.
Okay. All right. Tom, y'all go ahead and start in whatever order you like, and...
Yeah, let me make, if I could, just Sheriff Brzezinski, members of the committee. I'll probably end up repeating this, forgetting the formalities. It's been a while. But
starting off, could you please, for the record, identify yourself?
I just proved that my ability to forget the formalities.
Former representative.
Okay. I'm Tom Whelan, the proponent of this bill, along with I have at my side Tim Burr, who is a retired division chief from the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, handled their public information program all these years, and a longtime combatant in the fire safe cigarette wars, I might add. I also have with me Andrew McGuire, who is kind of the founding father of the concept. He was involved in fire safety issues in the 70s, and that rolled into the just naturally into the number one cause of burn injuries, and that is the cigarette-caused fire. And he's been, since 1979, fighting this battle. And he is the executive director of the Trauma Foundation at San Francisco General Hospital in San Francisco. Anyway, let me tell you how I came to this issue. I was a firefighter. I was a Salem firefighter. Spent my career here. Served in the House with several of the members here. And back in 97, there was a bill in 97 on a fire-safe cigarette. Completely escaped my notice. There had been bills from the late 70s through the 80s, well into the 80s. There was always a functional impossibility connected with it, and then that we could not require tobacco companies in any realistic way to provide for this tiny sliver of the market a fire-safe cigarette, even if they were admitting to being able to make them at the time. I came into this most recently just quite by accident. I was teaching a fire science class at a science magnet middle school in Portland, and I used the cigarette as an example of what is needed to fully explain what combustion is all about, the oxidation of a fuel. And when I taught at Salem Fire, I would use a cigarette as well, because it's just a marvelous balance of all the factors that are involved in combustion: the fuel, the geometry of the fuel, the proximity of the fuel, so that radiation, convection, and conduction can all occur to optimize the burn. You could basically use that to teach the fire triangle, which I did. And in the process of researching that, I discovered the internet was available to me, and I never had that opportunity as a fire captain. But I began to do the research and discovered, to my amazement, that there was in fact this was in 2004, a fire-safe cigarette that was being sold in the state of Oregon. And I have that with me. That's the Merit brand. And what the Merit brand does, when I heard about it, I ran down to the corner gasoline, to the corner gas station, and they had cigarettes there. I bought a pack of cigarettes, went back to the school with the kids. I'd been taking it out on the playground with the kids and lighting off cigarettes, and we'd watch it burn. I then would introduce gaseous 100% oxygen.
I just have the wrong picture.
Well, I tend to hyper-focus, and what I was missing was the sign directly alongside the front door of the school where I was doing this that directed all citizens not to do what I was doing. So at any rate, I put 100% oxygen on it, and they could see the impact of having straight oxygen instead of just atmospheric 21% oxygen. I then found sites on the web that they put in liquid oxygen. You had this blast of blinding light and a filter that is rocketing on fire off the view of the camera. So at any rate, I thought that was very interesting, and so I touched base with a longtime friend of mine, Chuck Tommen, who is an attorney, and we decided to make this into a project, and brought Tim Burr, pulled him out of retirement. And so the three of us have, just as volunteers, been taking this, shopping it around to the legislature, and inviting the response that is surely to come from those positions over my shoulder. We have got handouts along with some videos that we want to run for you. Some things are just made clearer by seeing them than having somebody yawn on about it, as I am doing. The first thing we have is a CNBC video that ran in January, is that correct? On New York State's Fire Safe Cigarette. Now, it passed in 2000, became law only last June 28th, after I had discovered the subject anew. And they were doing a review of the law and how it was going in New York State. We want to share that with you. I only saw it for the first time the other night, and I think you'll find it very interesting. And again, the difference between the fire-safe cigarette and the standard cigarette is, as Twain would say, the difference between the lightning and the lightning bug. So we like to run a few of these. In addition to that, after that runs and Tim has a chance to talk, we have got some local product. Paul Buck at K2 Television, when the bill dropped, showed an interest, did a two-part series on it, and we'd like to show those as well. So if you'll indulge us, we'll run the tape. Okay. I guess we are going to run the tape at the end. Put them back up. Yeah, we decided, apparently was not aware of this, to run them at the end. So what we'll do is just move on to Tim, and he can tell you his quarter century spin on the subject.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Tim Burr, and I reside at 12070 Southwest Fisher Road in Tigard. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bills 931 and 738. In addition to my written testimony, our trio has also conveyed to you two additional documents. To describe them, one of them is a paper which was done by Mr. McGuire, sitting to my left, and several collaborators, which examines the history of the cigarette fire safety issue through the tobacco industry's own documents, which is a particular interest interesting way to look at it. The other document that we have transmitted to you is a copy of a report that was released on January 24th of this year by the Harvard School of Public Health, which conducted some research on the first 6 months' experience in the state of New York. We provided you with a copy of that report. We have removed from it a very extensive set of dry numerical tables, which if any of you want, we will be glad to provide you with. So as far as my testimony is concerned, I'd like to begin by thanking this committee for giving both of these bills a hearing today. The issue that's before you this afternoon, whether you know it or not, is one that has been around the state of Oregon for nearly a quarter of a century now. And as I'm going to explain, it has found, we believe, a solution in at least two parts of the world. I just retired recently from a 30-year career in Oregon's fire service. I began my career as a Eugene firefighter in 1975 and in 2004 retired from Tualatin Dolly Fire and Rescue. During my tenure in the state's fire service, I have responded to literally thousands of fires, both as what we would call a line firefighter, one of the actual people that rides the big red trucks and squirts the water and climbs ladders and stuff. In addition, the latter part of my career, I served both Eugene and Tualatin Valley as one of their public information officers, which meant that in major fires, I was the person who responded and had to explain them via television to the folks at home. While I was still working as a Eugene firefighter in 1979, I was first appointed to serve as Eugene's public information officer. And in April of 1980, I responded to my first fatal fire in that capacity. It was a fire which occurred in a fraternity house just off the University of Oregon campus, and it took the life of a young woman. Our investigators determined that the cause of that fire was a cigarette which had been left in an overstuffed chair, and I, in fact, was one of the investigators who had the unpleasant task of actually packaging and removing the victim from that building in the wake of the fire. I was a young firefighter. It was the first time that I had seen a fire death that close, and to be honest, I was impacted by it. And I came across some things in my reading that talked about a controversy that was going on regarding the issue of cigarette fire safety. If you stop to think about it, it's pretty intuitive. If any of you have ever smoked yourselves, you know that a pipe, if not puffed on, goes out. You know that a cigar, if not puffed on, goes out. But there is something about commercially mass-produced cigarettes. And as I began reading and doing a little bit of research, I found that there was, in fact, an issue there. It was one that was being debated not only at the federal level in front of Congress, but in different places around the country. And in fact, in December of 1980, I wrote an essay on fire safety, which was published by Newsweek magazine as a My Turn column, in which, among other things, specifically addressed the issue of the self-extinguishing cigarette. In 1979, before I was involved in this, this body, the Oregon Senate, actually passed a memorial to the U.S. Congress urging them to do something about this issue and to adopt national legislation. Because Congress was failing to act, Oregon became one of a number of states in which local advocates pushed for state-level legislation. And I was part of that, along with the loose-knit coalition of fire service and public health officials, during the 1981 and the 1983 sessions of legislature. It proved to be an exercise in futility. And there were several factors. At that time, there was no recognized test or standards. And so had we even been successful in passing our law, the state fire marshal would have been tasked with actually doing the research and creating the standard, which would be a pretty major burden for that agency. The other thing that we found was that in those days, the political clout and the power of the tobacco industry was at its absolute zenith. And most of their work at that time was done by the Tobacco Institute, which was a centralized public relations and lobbying function. They sent representatives here to tell your predecessors in the Oregon Senate and the House that a safer cigarette was technically unfeasible. Beyond that testimony before not only the Oregon legislature but other legislatures around the country, the Tobacco Institute spent millions of dollars nationally on political contributions, which is free speech, and even worse, they spent money on the fire service itself. A series of grants were made to selected big city fire departments and national fire service organizations, which virtually assured that some of those most qualified to speak remained silent on this topic. Even some news organizations were reluctant to give it much coverage, especially if they were print publications that still had the Marlboro Man writing across their pages in the form of advertising. In the mid-1980s, the focus of this issue moved back to Congress. I had a number of new work assignments, and to be very honest about it, I was frustrated. I backed off, and I let the issue go. However, what I found when Tom called me and invited me to get back involved in this fray some weeks ago is that in the 20 years that I had been away from this issue, there were a lot of things that have changed. There are some things that haven't. Cigarettes are still killing people in Oregon, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But a lot of things have changed. In the mid-80s, while Congress did not pass national legislation, the compromise measure that came out of the U.S. Congress was that the tobacco industry agreed to a series of studies in which Mr. McGuire participated, in which there was scientifically validated research done. That proved that a cigarette could be made fire safe, and it proved that a standard and a testing mechanism could be created. The national tobacco litigation of the 1990s, including that large case in which attorneys general of a number of different states participated, resulted in a large volume of industry documents being placed on the public record as part of the discovery process. And in fact, one of the documents we shared with you is the fruit of that the fruit of that release of information. It is the internal memoranda within the industry that talks about cigarette fire safety. That, coupled with the testimony of people like Jeffrey Wigand, a former tobacco executive and the subject of the film The Insider, proof conclusively that by 1986 the tobacco industry had the ability to make a safer product in terms of fire safety. Finally, the state of New York became the first state to make this a reality, and as Tom said, since June 28th of last year, all cigarettes sold in New York must meet a state standard for fire safety. Canada quickly became the first nation to follow suit, and effective October 1st of this year, all cigarettes manufactured in Canada will have to meet a fire safety standard. As I said at the outset, the issue is simple, and we believe that the solution is as well. While I believe that we are closer today than ever in resolving this problem, for me personally, it is a bittersweet victory. On the evening of January 13, 2005, I was asked to respond to a two-alarm apartment fire in West Lynn. That fire took the life of a 43-year-old woman and displaced the families living in three adjacent apartments. As I said, some things have not changed during the time that I've been involved in this. I would dedicate my testimony here today to Laurel Style, the victim of the 1980 Eugene Fraternity House fire, to Pamela Lynn Hernandez, who died in West Lynn on the evening of January 13th of this year, and to the estimated over 20,000 Americans who died in the 24 years since I first became aware of this issue. And with your permission, we'd now like to show you that video clip. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm Andrew McGuire, Executive Director of the Trauma Foundation, which is an advocacy organization committed to preventing injuries of all kinds, firearm injuries, burn injuries, etc.
And can you tell us where the foundation's at?
At San Francisco General Hospital. Thanks. Yes. I'm going to make my testimony very brief. I have in my possession in my office a patent for a fire-safe cigarette from 1935. This patent calls for taking, let me have that cigarette for a second, it calls for taking the paper on cigarettes and in two spots around here, making the paper a little bit thicker. That thicker paper is what makes the cigarette when it's placed on a couch or a chair or whatever. When the burning coal gets to that thicker paper, it self-extinguishes. That's the 1935 patent. It's precisely the same technology employed by Philip Morris Corporation to make the Merit cigarettes sold in Oregon fire safe. And all cigarettes, all 755 different packing brands of cigarettes or sub-brands of cigarettes in New York, fire safe. So in New York State, when this law took effect, requiring that cigarettes self-extinguish, every single brand changed, including little tiny specialty brands that no one has ever heard of. They are all complying with the New York law and selling cigarettes that, according to the test method employed by the State Fire Marshal of New York, do not cause ignition in the test. One of the last things I want to mention is that I've testified on this issue three times in the U.S. Senate and House. I've testified, I believe this it will now be my ninth state legislature, I've testified on this issue. And in every single instance, I've obviously stayed after my testimony to listen to the testimony of the tobacco industry. The arguments that were used in the first House hearing in 1983 and the testimony I've heard in California, in other states, Massachusetts, etc., the arguments have remained consistent about why the cigarette companies are opposed to doing this. Those arguments in 1983 did not make sense, and today I can guarantee you will not make sense, because they are based on specious information, and I know that as a fact by going through the tobacco documents, which are now searchable by keyword online, and I've seen all their internal memos where they've created campaigns of disinformation. And so when you hear, for example, someone like a Mr. Jim Gould representing a cigarette company or others coming forward.
Ms. McGuire, I appreciate you wanting to tell us what they might say. He's here. He's going to speak for himself. I appreciate if you'll give us your comments as to what you've learned from your research, and then we'll look at the thing and we'll open up for questions. I just take a preference of allowing people to speak for themselves.
Right, and I understand that, and I apologize
that's
for doing that, Senator. I will conclude by saying, as was stated at the very beginning, pictures are worth more than words, and I'd like to show the video.
Thank you. I think we're now ready.
The senator, the chair, makes note of something you must have learned in the courtroom over the years. Being corrected by a judge insisting that the defendant has the opportunity to have his own lawyer speak for him.
Tobacco companies are quietly selling two different kinds of cigarettes, one safer than the other. The safer ones could save your life, even if you don't smoke. But they're only available in one state. Why? Senior correspondent Scott Cohn has been looking into it. Scott?
Tyler, I got two cigarettes here, and to look at them, they look pretty much the same. If I were to light them up, they would taste the same, I'm told. I'm not a smoker, but that's what they say. And they sell for the same price. But this one here is safer. It can still cause cancer, but it could save your life.
This is another way cigarettes can kill, the leading cause of fatal home fires in the U.S. More than 800 people die each year. Like Joseph Cavalieri, one of three New York City firefighters killed fighting this fire in 1998.
The reality of not seeing that person, of your whole lifestyle changing, of your children, you know, missing their dad, me missing him, just our entire family structure was changed.
Could this tragedy have been prevented? For decades, tobacco companies have known how to make cigarettes that are less likely to start fires. Firefighters in Suffolk County, New York, helped us demonstrate how they work. On one side of this old chair, we dropped one of the safer cigarettes. On the other, the old-fashioned kind.
Do I have to put it in the chair?
Within 5 minutes, the safer cigarette extinguishes itself.
And for all intents and purposes, it's out. It's out.
But the old one continues to smolder. 1 hour later, smoke is pouring from the chair, along with deadly carbon monoxide fumes. Then, after another hour and 20 minutes, after the smoker might well have gone to bed...
There you go.
The chair bursts into flames. Experts say this is how many cigarette fires start, smoldering at first, then suddenly out of control. The only difference between the cigarette that started this and the one that went out...
You see this?
The paper.
And you see this here?
Two bands, barely visible to the naked eye, where it's just slightly less porous. When a smoker is puffing on the cigarette, drawing air through the front, it works the same way as always. But put the cigarette down, and the bands act like speed bumps, absorbing heat, so most of the time, an unattended cigarette simply goes out. Government scientist Richard Gann, an expert on how things burn, helped develop the standard for the safer cigarettes.
We'll see a significant drop in cigarette-initiated fires, and if the number of fires goes down, the number of lives lost, the number of serious injuries should also come down.
And yet, the only place you can get the safer cigarettes is here in New York. And that only started in June, when New York became the first state to mandate them.
Every place else gets the old-fashioned kind.
Yeah, look at that.
Profits come first. And if you change the product somewhat,
Okay? They believe that they're going to lose consumers.
Former tobacco company scientist Jeffrey Wigand, the whistleblower made famous in the 1999 movie The Insider,
I told the truth,
knows cigarettes inside and out.
So why do they lose 2 cents on a cigarette or on a pack of cigarettes? Is that worth what is lost in property and, more importantly, what's lost in life?
Tobacco companies won't say how much it costs to make the safer cigarettes, but since the New York law went into effect in June, they haven't raised prices. Still, R.J. Reynolds, in its official position paper, opposes any legislation on so-called fire-safe cigarettes, saying there is no evidence they will significantly reduce the number of fires. Experts concede it's too early to tell if the New York law is preventing fires. But at the nation's largest cigarette maker, Philip Morris, they have a different concern. Even though the company has been selling one brand with the new technology, Merit, nationwide since 2000 with no apparent problems, the company is reluctant to go further on its own, for fear smokers won't like the new cigarettes and will switch brands.
People are still dying in these fires. Isn't that just a little bit cold and calculating?
Well, obviously, any issues related to tobacco are very complex. And, you know, I want to make sure that people understand. We absolutely understand the concerns that people have.
I mean, we're talking about lives versus competitiveness. Why not just lead the way?
Absolutely, and we may in fact do that. Again, at this point, it's early in the New York State situation. And again, from a competitive standpoint, we want all manufacturers to have to play by the same rules. And we believe that the way to address all of those issues is through federal legislation that would establish a national uniform policy.
But legislation has been stalled in Congress since 1978. New York Congressman Peter King, a co-sponsor, blames Big Tobacco.
Tobacco companies have never shown great insight over the years, or great foresight over the years. I think it's just one more mistake they're making.
Deborah Cavalieri says it shouldn't take an act of Congress.
Why does it take government to intervene? You know, aren't the people that are in charge, don't they realize that life is so precious and that something so small would be able to save how many lives?
But for now, tobacco companies continue selling two versions of their product. One that's designed to help prevent fires, and one that's not.
Again, these safer cigarettes are designed so there's no difference for the smoker except the slight chance they may have to relight their cigarette if they leave it sitting in an ashtray for too long. Now, New York could soon be getting some company. Canada's parliament later this month is expected to approve the first nationwide law requiring the safer cigarettes. In this country, proponents plan to introduce legislation yet again in the new Congress, hoping that this time it doesn't die.
Now, you were saying earlier today that these safer cigarettes, the fire-safe cigarettes, 75% of the time they'll go out.
That's the standard, and it's a lab test. That 75% of the time they should burn out when tested in the lab. We don't know yet about the real world, but that's the standard.
Interesting stuff, Scott. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Scott Cohn reporting. Our first up story on the closing bell this hour. It is hard to forget the dramatic picture you're about to see. An ordinary chair on fire, set ablaze by a smoldering cigarette dropped between the cushions. We showed you this demonstration last week on the closing bell as part of a CNBC investigation into why cigarettes that can prevent this kind of fire are not being widely sold in this country. Today, a new Harvard University study says the safer cigarette we first told you about could be saving lives, perhaps hundreds of lives, if tobacco companies would market it nationwide. Our senior correspondent Scott Cohn follows up now on his first report. Scott.
Tyler, thank you. As we reported last week, the safer cigarettes are only readily available in New York and only after New York began requiring them by law last June. The cigarettes are designed to extinguish themselves when left unattended to combat the leading cause of fatal fires in the U.S., careless smoking. The Harvard study, funded by money from the nationwide tobacco settlement, says, quote, there is no valid reason why cigarette manufacturers should not sell the safer cigarettes nationwide, end quote. But cigarette makers continue to resist.
When we dropped a New York cigarette between the cushions of this old chair, the cigarette went out within 5 minutes.
It's out.
But the same brand purchased in Virginia continued to smolder, and eventually the chair burst into flames. The only difference, two bands where the cigarette paper is slightly less porous, acting like heat-absorbing speed bumps. But even though they're already mass-producing the cigarettes for New York, tobacco companies are still reluctant to sell them nationwide for fear customers won't like them.
We're talking about lives versus competitiveness. Why not just lead the way?
Absolutely, and we may in fact do that. Again, at this point, it's early in the New York State situation.
But not too early, say researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health.
All of the reasons the tobacco industry have put up in the past to prevent passage of important legislation that would save lives from fire deaths, I believe, have been addressed by the New York standard.
Comparing cigarettes purchased in New York with the same brands purchased in California and Massachusetts, the study found the New York cigarettes work. They put themselves out 90% of the time. Tobacco companies didn't raise prices in New York, despite saying early on the technology would cost more. And consumers appear to like them just fine. Based on tax receipts, cigarette sales in New York haven't suffered since the law took effect. New York smokers told us they don't notice any difference, even this smoker who saw our report.
I can't tell the difference.
I always smoke the same brand.
And no difference?
No.
I believe it's time that this industry started selling these products not only in the state of New York, but in the other 49 states.
But Big Tobacco has different views. A spokesman for Lorillard tells CNBC the study doesn't show whether those cigarettes are effective in preventing fires. R.J. Reynolds says regulations are still not an effective means to address the problem. And Philip Morris, which says it supports a federal law, says it is still reviewing the study.
But tobacco companies may soon have no choice. Bolstered by the Harvard study, Massachusetts Congressman Edward Markey says he plans to reintroduce federal legislation requiring the safer cigarettes nationwide. The legislation, though, in one form or another, has languished in Congress since 1978. Tyler?
The Harvard study says that these cigarettes perform the way they are supposed to perform, i.e. they go out three quarters of the time when left unattended like that. So then how in the world can one of the tobacco companies, I can't remember which one it was, say the Harvard study doesn't prove that?
It doesn't prove, they say, that the study or that regulations prevent, that regulations for so-called fire-safe cigarettes prevent fires.
But the regulations prevent the fire.
And that the standard prevents fires. It just shows that in the lab, these cigarettes went out, and in fact, in the Harvard study, they went out 90% of the time. The standard only requires 75% of the time.
All right, Scott, thanks very much. Scott Cohn will be following that story for us, and it is a big one.
Did you have one other thing that you wanted to present?
Sheriff Brzezinski, members of the committee, this started out as a fire-safe cigarette bill that would reduce the number of fire deaths and fire losses related to cigarettes that were left on mattresses, in couches, upholstered furniture, bedding. That is the type of fire that we experienced as firefighters, as structural firefighters, city firefighters. But there's an additional element at play here in Oregon, and that is the acute conditions in the wildlands of Oregon right now. This is I believe the fourth driest winter in the last 60 years, and we've already had, this did not happen during my experience as a firefighter, we've already had a rash of serious wildland fires that have exposed houses to the fires as well. I had contacted, after discussing this with one of your colleagues who is from Central Oregon, bringing the Department of Forestry into this. They're very excited about this. They have had, I believe, over the last 10 years, just the Department of Forestry lands alone have had like 675 cigarette-caused forest fire incidents. And so if they're coming in at a clip of about 70 a year, anything that could be done to reduce those would work as well. Now, although this has been tested on a substrate, polyurethane, with the type of fabrics you find in household use, the fact that this thing will only burn back about a half inch and stop offers some hope for those occasions when the substrate is a forest floor, the one-hour fuels that make up a forest floor. Now, somewhere between the snowpack melting, and there is none this year in the Cascades at least, and the acute conditions that start to develop in August, September, October, there's going to be occasions when a reduced ignition propensity cigarette, such as the FireSafe brand sold in New York, are going to have a positive result on the forest fire hazards here in Oregon. It's just scientifically impossible to explain how that could otherwise occur. And so, what I'd like to do, the K2 story on the upholstered furniture test that they ran up at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue with Tim goes over some of the ground that you've seen covered fairly exhaustively here. So we're going to skip that, and we're going to go to the one that was broadcast the following Monday when the rash of wildland fires had occurred. And I got a phone call from Paul Buckta, the reporter at K2, asked me if I knew anything about the promise this might hold for forest fires, and I said, I will send you a file that I just got from the Department of Forestry. I had not printed it out, but it's the one that itemized the numbers of wildland fires they'd had over the years caused by cigarettes. So what I'd like to do is run that now for you to give you some sense of the urgent situation that existed as of 2 weeks ago, and impress upon you the need to get this thing up and rolling and try to get it through both houses, signed by the governor, and into law before we get into the worst of the fire season.
Thank you.
And wages.
Our dry winter weather has become unusually warm as the temperature reached 70 degrees in several cities.
And it's really feeling warm for firefighters who are doing their summer right now. K2's Paul Buchta begins our live team coverage. Paul?
Yeah, we're covering wildfires, and it's only February, and here's the problem. I lit this cigarette about 5 minutes ago. It's burning, and it'll continue to burn. You throw this into dry grass, it's just fuel for the fire.
The weather doesn't feel like February, where a wildland fire burns in Boring. And the brush doesn't sound like it's February here in Milwaukee.
I could hear it crackling, and then after that I couldn't really hear any more of it.
Earlier today, Clackamas County firefighters fought a half-acre brush fire right here under conditions they'd expect in June or July. Firefighters believe one careless act and dry conditions sparked the brush fire.
These homes could have been threatened by this discarded cigarette as the small fire became larger and started to spread to some heavier materials.
Firefighters also believe a discarded cigarette sparked a fire here in the Villa King Apartments, where the flames could have easily raced out of control.
People flicking cigarettes and whatnot out here. Somebody was throwing firecrackers at one point last night.
Dry weather and cigarettes are a volatile mix.
Ready? Yep.
Last week in a K2 test, we showed you the power of a smoldering cigarette. We lit the cigarette, placed it on a chair, then waited and waited. 2 hours, 15 minutes later, the chair erupts in fire. Conversely, a fire-safe cigarette self-extinguished in 4 minutes. Firefighters and others support pending legislation to require all Oregon cigarettes to be fire safe. They fear what the calls could be like this summer.
If this dry weather continues, it does have the potential to be an explosive fire season.
And here are all the wildfires caused by cigarettes in the past 10 years. As you can see, it is a very, very long list, and I'm still holding a handful of them here. As for the cigarette that we've lit, you can see that it is still burning. Right next to it, we have a fire-safe cigarette. That's one that's sold in New York. It's the only state that requires it. It's self-extinguished. In about 4 or 5 minutes' time, burned down about 15 millimeters or so. So you can see what firefighters are concerned about just right in here. Live in Northeast Portland, Paul Buchta, K2 News.
My list is way too long, Paul Buchta. Thank you, sir. Dry winter.
Chair Przanski, that concludes our case. I'd just like to add as a footnote that the entire Oregon Fire Service is enthusiastically in support of this. Nurses, burn centers, and a growing list of business insurance advocates as well. So thank you very much. We'll take whatever questions you may have.
Thank you. Colleagues, questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. If you want to stand by, we'll, I'm going to first have Representative Greenwich come on up and testify. I know he's been waiting patiently, has to probably get back to some other duties, and then we'll get back onto the list. And
thank you very much, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenland, House District 33, and I'm very pleased to be here today to support the bills you have in front of you. I first got involved in this issue in the period from 1968 to 1972 when I was a young, impetuous lad on the Action Board and the Governing Council of the American Public Health Association. We took two issues at that time to deal with public health safety. One had to do with moving towards mandatory seatbelts, and the other had to do with fire-safe cigarettes. Both industries resisted those kinds of efforts, but eventually seatbelts became quite available, and the industries accepted seatbelts as a standard of safety, saving lives in the auto industry. The tobacco industry fought very hard against it when we tried to move these into Congress. We couldn't even get a bill introduced. And the main argument at the time, even though it turns out to be specious, knowing what we know now, was that it wasn't technically feasible to create a cigarette that would be fire safe and efficient and also satisfy the smokers of the country, who were much more of a concern in 1970 than they are in 2005, 35 years later. When I heard that New York was moving with its statute and Canada was considering moving forward, last July I began drafting a bill that's basically identical to the bill you have in front of you today. It was introduced as House Bill 2942. I don't think it makes a difference which house this comes from and whose name is on the bill. What I do think is very critical from somebody who spent 40 years of life working to try and save lives in the public health area is that we must pass this bill now. It's completely feasible, it's economically feasible, and the time is right to move ahead. Would we be better off having a national law that made this the standard in all 50 states? Absolutely, we would be better off having a national law. But in the meantime, the lives of Oregonians are at stake. And I really urge you to move this bill forward as quickly as you can. I'll help work on it in the House and make sure that it gets out of there and we can begin to save the lives of the potential lives of so many Oregonians. I thank you for taking your attention with this bill today.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the representative? Thank you very much, Mitch.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm going to go back onto the agenda. I also want to just put on the record that I had asked a person by the name of Melvin Thornton. Mr. Thornton is the, I believe, the executive director of what's known as the Douglas Fire Protection Association, to provide me with what information he may have regarding fires that were brush fires or forest fires that they would have jurisdiction over. And I've just had that handed out to the committee, and I believe there's extra copies that are being put in the back for those who may be interested in that. It includes not only stuff regarding the Douglas District, but also he also received information off the, I assume off the website for the Oregon Department of Forestry. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and go back on the agenda of people wanting to give testimony. And I have Nancy Orr. And I'm going to ask, is there anyone else here that wanted to be giving testimony in support of either of these two bills, Senate Bill 738 or Senate Bill 931? Ms. Orr, thank you very much for joining us.
Chair Posansky, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Orr, State Fire Marshal. Cigarette-caused fires have been perennially a leading cause, usually the leading cause, of residential home fire deaths in Oregon. The Office of State Fire Marshal and the Oregon Fire Service has spent countless resources in education efforts regarding cigarette-caused fires. And while public education is effective, there's one problem that it cannot has not been able to solve, and I don't think can solve, and we need an engineering change to address that. And the problem is that people who I think generally would be caring and careful are often causing cigarette-caused fires when they are impaired by alcohol, medications or drugs, fatigue, or other impairments. We're seeing a definite trend where nearly all of the smoking-caused deaths in Oregon were caused by a smoker who had some impairment. And for this, we need an engineering change. And I believe that this bill can bring about that change in Oregon and have a significant impact on our cigarette-caused fires in Oregon. Most of those who die in cigarette-caused fires in Oregon are impaired, or they are members of the household or an adjoining apartment. The cost to implement this legislation in Oregon is minimal. Oregon, or the New York State Fire Marshal, has carried most of the water on this and has developed a standard that is industry accepted and nationally recognized. The enforcement of this act certainly lies within the mission of the Office of State Fire Marshal. We would not need additional employees to enforce this act, and we have sufficient revenues to pay for the testing of the sampling without raising any fees or establishing new fees. I respectfully request your support for this bill.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Orr? Thank you very much for being here. All right, what I'm going to do is, it appears from my list, my review, and my question I just asked as to whether or not there are any other proponents. The opponents, what I'd like to do is allow for the representatives of the cigarette companies to first testify. I have retail sale here as well, but I think I'd like to start off with those who are here. I know at least, I believe, Mr. Gould, you've traveled some distance to get here. So please come on up. And Mr. Linden says that he does not need to testify. I believe we have David May, who's also here.
Yes.
And, sir, it appears that Rich and Ryan, is that?
Purveyor of cigarettes.
All right. You're more than welcome to come up now, or if you want to come up second, your choice.
Not matter to me.
Okay, why don't you come on up? We'll just do a panel, and that way we'll allow y'all to get started, and then we'll take it from there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Gould. I'm here representing Laurel Ard and R.J. Reynolds. Both of these bills are based on and are mirror legislation which was enacted in New York in mid-2000. That's more than 4.5 years ago. And no other state has followed suit since. And there have been hearings literally from Maine to California, from Augusta to Sacramento, in which no other state has chosen to adopt this approach. It was true in previous years. It's true so far this year, including after all of the kinds of things you've been exposed to by the proponents of the legislation. Why is that? Well, first, there were a couple of lines in the TV show, which was very effective advocacy, but I noted them. It's the first time I'd seen that. One, experts say it's too early to tell. That was a brief line in there. And then a little later on, we don't know yet about the real world. That's very much the situation now. The New York regulations are based on a test described as a laboratory test. Let me explain what it is. You take a cigarette and you put it on 10 layers of filter paper. It's called Wattman filter paper. Think of it like heavy-duty Mr. Coffee filter paper. It's just thicker. It's closer to cardboard. And you do that inside an enclosed chamber that's like an aquarium with a little chimney coming out of it. and then you see, does the cigarette go out? So when we talk about regulations requiring the cigarettes to go out, we're talking about regulations that require the cigarettes to go out when they're placed on this stack of filter paper in an enclosed environment. We're not talking about regulations that involve furniture, fabrics, foams, mattresses, the real world materials that are what where fires unfortunately arise. We're told, well, this is stalled in Congress. That's the way television reporters always talk about something. Well, the New York approach is based on this filter paper test, which was developed by federal research in the early 1990s as part of a program under legislation that required the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the National Consumer Safety Watchdog Federal Agency, to report to Congress on that work. Well, what did they report to Congress? And I brought a copy and I'll leave it for you. I brought the key part I want to read to you. In a report to Congress, overview, practicability of developing a performance standard to reduce cigarette ignition propensity. Executive summary, first substantive conclusion. While the Commission concludes that it is practicable to develop a performance standard to reduce cigarette ignition propensity, it is unclear that such a standard will effectively address the number of cigarette-ignited fires. In other words, there are measures we could adopt, but we don't know, it's unclear whether they will work. CPSC reported the same thing a little over a year ago in the Federal Register. The extent to which lower IP, that's the technical term, cigarettes may reduce the risk of ignition of upholstered furniture and other home furnishings is currently unknown. And that related to what's going on in New York. Again, from reading from the Federal Register, their words, not mine. So what's going on presently in Washington is a focus on the materials that are not supposed to burn. Furniture, mattresses. Cigarettes burn. There's no such thing. We all wish it were different, but there is no such thing as a fire-safe cigarette. They burn. That's what they do to be smoked, to be used, whether you like it or not. So the focus increasingly at the federal level has been on improvements on the materials that are not supposed to burn, furniture, mattresses, making them resistant. So that if you, not only to children playing lighter with lighters and matches, an increasing problem, but specifically to resistance to furniture, or to cigarettes. That's the route California went a long time ago, and it has virtually extinguished, and I mean that literally, careless smoking fires in that state. Now, I said it was, the TV report we saw said it is too early to tell. That's true. The New York regulations took effect June 28, 2004, but that's an oversimplification. They're phasing in product that was in wholesaler and retailer inventories before that could be sold through. So you don't have any kind of break point where you can say, okay, this is when the change occurred. But in any event, we don't have the New York statistics for 2004 as to whether there has been any real-world impact. The reporting deadline for the previous year is March 31. It will be a little difficult to tell anyway for 2004 because of the phase-in nature of this. But everyone is very anxious, as me as much as anyone, to see, okay, despite what the Consumer Product Safety Commission said, and despite the rejection by every other state but New York of this, is there going to be a significant real-world difference? The whole world wants to know. I think that's a legitimate use of the expression in this occasion. However, one thing we do know about this problem, and it's something you ought to take into consideration, is, I mean, if I were trying to be in your shoes, one of the questions I would ask is this problem increasing or decreasing? And we do know that over the last 24 years, since 1980, when the National Fire Protection Association began keeping track of these things, careless smoking fires have declined by 67%. Careless smoking fire injuries have declined by 67%. Careless smoking fire deaths by 61%. So this picture is getting better. We wish there were no such thing. We all do. But there's only so much legislation can do, and there's only so much you can do with a product that burns to be used. And that's why the focus has been on the things that have been shown to work in the real world. Life is full of trade-offs also. There's some things that weren't mentioned in the television reports. And that is, if you take a cigarette and you do something to make it burn inefficiently, it has consequences. It changes the performance of the cigarette. It was predicted in much of the federal research, and it's been corroborated that when you take a technology that makes a cigarette burn inefficiently, you change the smoke. And the Harvard report that was mentioned by the supporters of the legislation reports, for example, an 11.4% increase in carbon monoxide in the four leading brands that were tested in that study. Now, it's still early days, and those are just four brands, but there are a number of other increases reported across the board as well. Now, that's the kind of question that someone has to resolve. Do we want to go with this technology even if the indications are that there's an increase in carbon monoxide or whatever? Those are regulators' decisions. I would submit to you that they're best made in Washington, with all due respect to Salem. There are other aspects as well that haven't been mentioned. It was said by the supporters, or at least the television, someone talking on television, and there are a number of people who are very heartfelt advocates of tobacco control or anti-smoking, and that's their privilege, of course. But it was said, oh, there's been no impact whatever in New York. Well, I brought with me the New York fiscal reports. They issue hard data, not talking head commentary for TV cameras, but the actual revenue figures on a month-by-month basis. And what they show is, I brought January 2005, a 10% decline from January 2004 in cigarette tax revenues. They also report a 4.1% decrease for the current fiscal year in progress compared to the previous fiscal year. Now, there was no tax increase in New York during this intervening period, and I did my best to average what is happening to state revenues during the 6 months or so of phase-in, and my average is a 4.5% decline for the state of New York during that period. I've also brought with me copies of fiscal notes issued by two of the other states that have held hearings thus far this year on very similar bills. New Hampshire, which projected a 2% decline in state tax revenue based on figures that were provided to them by New York, where New York reported that it had budgeted a 2% decline due to these regulations. This is in the fiscal note. I'll leave a copy for you. And if what I'm seeing is right, we're seeing that that 2% was understated by a factor of double or more. Same for state of Maine. I brought copies of the fiscal notes they issued, where they projected, again, a 2% decline for every fiscal year going out that they look forward through 2009. But again, these fiscal notes, as I understand it, were issued before New York's January 2005 data that I've mentioned became available. You'll hear from local business. They can far better speak to their concerns than I. But I guess in closing, the main point I would raise is, you hear this, and you know, it's very easy to say, okay, here's something that might be safe or might improve public safety, but we don't know that yet. And we do know, at least I believe, that the place to decide that is for a product like cigarettes, which are a nationwide product, is in Washington. In the same way that when the, I don't know if any of you remember, in the 1964 Surgeon General's report came out, okay, cigarettes cause cancer. Everyone wanted a warning to go on the pack, understandably. States had ideas, cities had ideas, federal government had idea, and the sensible solution was to establish it on a uniform basis. If we do see a major reduction in fires in New York, that'll be great. And obviously that will have nationwide implications. But we don't have that yet. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think, Mr. May, before we have you testify, just because I think you're going to give us a different perspective, that maybe we should go ahead and do questions at this point with Mr. Gould. And so I'll ask him some questions. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Gould, are you talk about revenue going down. Are you saying that there's something about these cigarettes that make people smoke less?
We don't really know yet. It's too early. We do know that there's been a move in New York to other sources of cigarettes, which are readily available in New York. That is, whether they're from out of state or you have Indian tribes selling on the basis of them being sovereign nations, and I'm not taking any position on that under Oregon law or whatever, a move away from these cigarettes, yes.
So you're saying that if we adopt this, that people are going to go across the borders and just bring in the other cigarettes because these taste funny?
I'm saying that it's something that if I were in your shoes, I'd be watching to see how the situation shakes out in New York.
And you also, to follow up, Mr. Chairman, you also said that four brands had been tested and had increased carbon monoxide.
Carbon monoxide.
I said carbon monoxide.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
What did that study attribute it to? I mean, I don't understand how a cigarette going out could produce more carbon monoxide.
Oh, well, no, the point is, it didn't involve them going out. It's taking a cigarette and measuring using the standard machine that's used. If you've ever, I don't know if you look at cigarette ads, there's a standard, again, a uniform nationwide program of X milligrams tar, X milligrams nicotine, etc. And was applying that technology, that measuring technique, to cigarettes that had the speed bumps that were referred to and the same brand which did not.
And also, you know, I was a little concerned that you said the solution is to make furniture fireproof when they're doing alarming studies that's finding these fire retardant chemicals in breast milk. I mean, I can't imagine that you would suggest that as a solution to this when they have a terrible toxic risk, cancer causing, et cetera.
There's no doubt that one of the unfortunate things that has occurred in the fire safety area is some measure that everyone thinks is really terrific turns out to have unintended consequences. I agree, it's happened a number of times. I do know that with respect to fire retardants on fabrics used in furnishings, that Congress mandated a study of that, and it came back a couple of years ago that there were eight out there that had been chemicals that had been through all of the batteries of tests that people use for this kind of thing and were okay. That's not to suggest anyone should be lax about that at all, of course.
Mr. Chair, one final question. If you find the data from New York indicates that these are preventing fires, are you going to be leading the charge at the federal level to make this nationwide?
I would expect that if there is a significant decline and people are prepared to accept whatever other consequences, and I can't predict what the outcome of that equation will be. I know there'll be action in Washington, that's certain. I can't predict what my role will be in it.
Any other questions?
Mr. Gill, I do have a few questions based on your testimony. I just want to get some clarification. I guess I just want to start off with how many states do you know have actually considered legislation since the New York law was passed?
Okay. My estimate, the ones I know of, if I tried to sit down and make a list, I think I would put 10 to 15 on it.
Okay. My understanding, and did you know that I believe you brought up New Hampshire as an example, mm-hmm. as to having a potential decrease in revenue about 2% based mm-hmm. on what information had been given to New York. It's my understanding the New Hampshire, they just passed 15-0 similar legislation out of one of the two chambers.
I know one of the committees voted for it. Yep.
Okay. And so it looks like maybe they're maybe moving forward at this as we speak today to try to take some steps in that state. Do you know of any others that are currently having similar legislation this year?
Yeah. I know that the state of Maine, same committee as its New Hampshire counterpart, voted 7-2 ought not pass. The week or so before. I know that Arkansas Rules Committee was something like 15-2 ought not pass. I had the privilege of being in Montpelier, Vermont for a hearing, but last I had heard there had not been a committee vote.
Thank you.
Those are the ones that I know of as far as activity.
All right. A couple other questions. I just want to follow up on the carbon monoxide myself mm-hmm. to the attribute to cigarettes. If I'm hearing that line of reasoning, do you know whether or not pipe tobacco or cigars have higher carbon monoxide? Because what I'm understanding is that there is something that okay, causes sure. those tobacco products to, let's say, self-extinguish, and I assume it's that they do not have similar combustible chemicals to maintain the cigarette burning. I'm wondering if you, in your history, know whether or not there's an increase in carbon monoxide for those type of products.
No, I'm sorry. I just don't
okay.
know much or anything about that would help you with an answer to that.
Let me ask you a couple other questions. Do you know if there's been any lawsuits that have been filed, Mike, based on what's happened in New York as to actually now having something in place mm-hmm. that has these fire-safe cigarettes? It would appear to me that if there is a cigarette that causes either a fatality or significant damage, that a tobacco company may find itself on the end of a lawsuit knowing that they have a product that could, in fact, been distributed and for sale. I'm wondering if you know if there's any lawsuits that are pending as to a tobacco manufacturer not providing fire-safe cigarettes mm-hmm. in any state.
I don't know of any cases that are currently pending. I do know, well, it ended about 5-6 years ago. There was a case in Texas that was settled some years ago, 5 years ago. There's a string of decisions holding that, I don't know how to put it because I don't want to suggest I don't take this very seriously, but that there are certain forms of carelessness or negligence people do that are so overwhelmingly the problem that that's as far as the courts go. And that, then there was also one very major, very intensively litigated case, and Mr. McGuire, who preceded me, was certainly involved, in Boston. A very sad fire, multiple fatalities. And the court took a very long and careful look at the science as well and said, look, I cannot make the leap from the idea that a cigarette which performs well in the kind of laboratory conditions we're talking about has anything to do with the setting and the materials in which that fire occurred, and dismiss the case.
Okay. I've got a couple others and I'll come back. Regarding the study that you brought forward on New York as seeing revenue being decreasing, I'm wondering if you know if New York has had any tobacco cessation type programs. I'll just give you an example here in Oregon, based on the master settlement, some of the money has been used or was being used, and we actually saw a decline based on the type of advertising that was going forward, and specifically with youth. And I'm wondering if you know whether or not those numbers that you've given to us could also reflect that that's based on some type of other prevention programs they may have put in place at the time.
It would surely be very difficult to break out and assign percent by percent figures. I do know, and I've been happy to bring the New Hampshire in particular fiscal note, where they consulted New York and asked for figures about these specific regulations, and were told, okay, we're projecting a 2% decline. I do know that in New York over this time period, no tax increases. There were major smoking bans, but those took place a full year before. Every state has a lot of other cessation programs, and that's fine. I can't give you more precise data. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I've got two other points I want to make. One was the example that we saw in the video with the chair. I mean, from my perspective, I'm assuming that nothing had been, quote-unquote, tampered with. And it does appear from that video that the one that was the New York brand of cigarette did have a... I guess the desired goal of going out, where the other one, after 1 hour, showed some sense of continuing to smolder, and within another hour, actually being in blaze. Is there some reason why you think one of the one cigarette resulted in the fire actually developing as compared to the other one?
I have to admit I have some skepticism about television. Dateline TV type, you know, ABC, what I would call it, and the scientific experiments with one cigarette and one, you know, whether it's a car that rolls over or a gas tank or whatever. So I cannot address what was done there. I do know that when studies have been done involving a wide range of actual real-world materials, and gee, okay, if you take a cigarette and it does well on this lab test, do you see an end to ignitions of actual fabrics? No.
Okay. One last question, and it's based on what Senator Burdick asked you as to the advocacy is what you or your company may be doing in D.C. If the New York studies does, in fact, demonstrate that. You made the comment that if there's significant decline, can you please define this to me, what would be significant enough to have the company actually make that shift?
No, I can't, just because I'm not a statistician. But, I mean, I think if we were looking at a... I can't get it. You do have, caution, you have volatility in fire statistics because it's, you know, human behavior. But if we saw, and I don't know what percentage, I can't quote your percentage, but everyone's watching and waiting to see, and if it looks like this is really working, there's going to be a lot of people picking up on that, and including tobacco companies.
Great. Thank you for your time. Senator Wissett.
Chair Brzezinski, Mr. Gould, I just have two questions. One, can you give us an idea what it would cost, the cost differential between using the regular paper and using the other paper?
No, each manufacturer I'm aware of treats its cost information as proprietary. I have heard reports, anecdotes, that if you were to go to a cigarette paper manufacturer, and there's one in the United States, and you know, you were assuming you were going in the business, let's say, and ask for a quote on the, call it New York paper versus the other, there's a very significant price differential at all at that level. But I don't really have much more I can tell you on that.
And follow up to you, I think on that same question, would you think that if there were only one paper being used, then it would still be higher? If it was mandated on a national basis and there was only one type of paper being used, do you think that would still be a higher cost?
Well, armchair economist, if there were something that attracted additional manufacturers of paper to get into the market and add competition, I would expect that to drive the price down. But I'm just speculating.
Another question, yep. Mr. Brzezinski. I think in the danger of smoking as far as creating fire, unintentional fire, one would be in discarding a lighted cigarette. One would be in falling embers off a cigarette, particularly like when you're driving. You know. Mm-hmm. And the third thing would be in discarding a lighted match. So if you have a cigarette that goes out, mm-hmm. and you relight it, would there be a significant increase in the possibility of fires from discarded matches as opposed to, I used to smoke a pipe, so you know mm-hmm. I'm talking about, you know, two puffs and you relight it, you know, mm-hmm. you got a whole steel hole full of a little bit of tobacco, a whole bunch of matches, mm-hmm. and I was just wondering if there might be a significant increase in the possibility of potential fires as a result of those matches. I mean, we used to see the commercials where you pinch it to make sure it's out before you kick the match out. So I would wonder if any study has been done or any thoughts been given to that process.
I suppose the more you have people lighting matches, the more there's at least a theoretical risk of fire, you know, if you had calculated some ratio of fires to matches, but I don't know of any data. I do know, by the way, that the question of the ember coming out, that is something in which the government in Washington, the Justice Department, has made claims that there is an increased risk associated with these cigarettes, the New York, so to speak, cigarettes.
Any other questions from the panel? All right, excuse me, Mr. Gold.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
What should I do with these if I'm
I think our
assistant. Or just bring them over there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. May, I apologize for bringing up. I thought we were going to be able to do this. Please give us your testimony.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is David May. I'm president of Rich and Rhine. Rich and Rhine is a distributor of cigarettes, and if I can, this is perspective from my point of view. As I have read these bills, it is my understanding that the goal is to adopt fire safety for the consumer. Specifically, limit the risk that a cigarette will ignite upholstered furniture, mattresses, or other household furnishings. It is also my understanding that we would be the second state to adopt this law behind the state of New York. If this bill were adopted as law, we would create irreparable damage to our business, if not to the cigarette industry in general. With about 200 licensed distributors in the state, Rich and Rhine is not the largest, but far from a small player in the business. To put all of this in perspective, Rich and Rhine does about $50 million of business per year and nets about $103,000 of that in profit. That's 0.2%. Not a great return, and yes, this is atypical of the business. We carry about $3 million of cigarettes in inventory. We also stamp for the state of Washington. If this bill were to become law, we would have to have separate inventories for the two states. By having two inventories, we would lose our economies of scale and would have to increase our inventory about 20% or $600,000. Not unlike other businesses, we also have a line of credit that we use on a daily basis. at the current rate, providing that there is no more federal increase in the prime interest rate, we would incur another $36,000 per year of interest alone. This does not take into consideration the fact that our labor would increase about 20% in the cigarette department, which would equal about $10,192 on an annualized basis. And to accommodate these changes, there would be the cost of restructuring the warehouse and the purchase of new racking for the separate inventory of about $6,000. The total for the first year of this proposed law would impact our operation of about $52,000, which is over 50% of our net profit, which $46,000 of this would be an ongoing expense. The question would be, will this sink the company? The answer would be no. But there would be no room for error. If that were the extent of the impact, it would be a tough pill to swallow, but we would get through it. The remaining issues would be, one, all of the cigarette manufacturers are not up to retooling to supply even the state of New York, and theirs became law in June of 2004. Where does that leave us with two states strong that demand the manufacturers provide us with the same product in a completely different packaging? What about cost? I'm sure there would be cost increases for a manufacturer to modify the product. Is this a wise move with the bordering state that has a major city just across the river? Now comes a part of irreparable damage. Yes, this would put us out of business. About 20% of our cigarette sales are done by what we call fourth tier product. To simplify, product that is manufactured overseas at a reduced cost. This 20% of the cigarette business generates about 39% of the cigarette gross profit, which would be a loss of about $250,000 a year. Now, with only two states requiring the new paper, these overseas companies at this time have no desire to retool to accommodate for us when there are 48 other states that they can sell to. A matter of simple economics. As you can see, the total expected cost to Rich and Rind to change over would be a minimum of $302,000 the first year. At this cost, we would be able to do business for about the first 4 months of the new law. How and who will this new law impact? Well, it will impact the Oregon State employment by the loss of 40 family-supporting jobs, not to mention one of the oldest supporters of the Oregon Steps to Success program, the tax base that has been provided to the state for over a half a century, and roughly $10 million of cigarette stamp and tobacco tax that is provided to the state on an annual basis from Rich and Rind. One might ask, wouldn't this business be absorbed by the other businesses? A lot of the other businesses would battle the same scenario that I've just pointed out. And the answer is yes. A lot of it would go to other businesses, such as the Internet, 800 number businesses, Indian reservations, and over the border to the neighboring state. So you have to ask yourself the reason for the bill. Limit the risk that the cigarette will ignite upholstered furniture, mattresses, or other household furnishings. If this is the reason for the bill, wouldn't it be time better spent in trying to adopt a safety device for the open flame at the kitchen stove or to outlaw indoor burning candles? With this insight, I ask that each one of you give this bill serious thought to the impact that it would inflict to this industry.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. May. Any questions from Mr. May?
I do. Just one. That's a very, very narrow margin of profit, certainly.
Yes, it is.
If you had in your line of credit, if you had a change of 1%, incremental change of 1% in interest rate going up, what would that cost you within, you know, can you give us an idea? Right now, your whole...
I'm based on prime. I borrow $6 million on a daily basis. I'm prime plus 1.5. So mm-hmm. if that answers your question on a roundabout basis.
The annualized 1% on $6 million. Okay, yeah. Chunk of money.
Yes, that's atypical of the business. It's a competitive football, cigarettes are.
Mm-hmm.
questions? Mr. May, just one question for you regarding this, the fourth tier.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what was in that report, they talked about the various brands. There's 200 or something that's in New York State. I'm assuming some of those have to be ones that are being imported in. Do you have any information as to what impact, if any, it's had on those brands not being available now?
As as recent as yesterday, JT International, which does Export A's and among other things, have to this point not been able to service New York for the lack of retooling. Now, I understand that they are. Whether that will happen or not, I do not know.
Thank you.
If I may add one thing bearing on that, which I had intended to mention, one of the other things we don't know about New York is how is enforcement going to work, or if it will happen. They have not, and I check. I got to know the New York folks during the course of the working there. They have not begun doing testing. We don't know of any street-level enforcement. They haven't appropriated the money, figured out what it will cost, that kind of thing. So as far as what will happen, the full consequences at the retail level, they haven't developed yet.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have on the list Dan Floyd and Chris Gerard.
Gerard,
excuse me. Mr. Gerard, I'm going to let you go first since you're not here on a regular basis. Mr. Floyd gets to come see us every once in a while. So.
Well, I'm glad that...
Actually, every day.
Every day. I have some handouts if those could be distributed.
Yeah, she'll get them out. She just has to do a little typing to make it there, and we'll get them real quick.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chris Gerard. I'm president and CEO of Plaid Pantries, Inc. I'm also a director of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, or ONSA, O-N-S-A. You probably know Richard Kosasan, who is our director, executive director. Plaid Pantry owns and operates 103 neighborhood stores in the Northwest, 94 of which are right here in Oregon. The Oregon Neighborhood Store Association is responsible for legislative and regulatory representation for Oregon's 2,500 smaller, mostly family-owned and operated stores. I'm not here today to tell you that safer cigarettes are a bad thing. In fact, as you already know, other states are considering legislation similar to what we're looking at today. New York has recently implemented such standards. And in my testimony, I say there's federal legislation in the works. I'd like to actually, since I composed this testimony, I got an update from our national association in Alexandria. And there are discussions going on. There are people working on uniform standards so that we don't have different paper in all different states. I also got an anecdotal update on the New York situation. It was kind of surprising. I won't swear to it, but I do want to follow up on it. Somebody mentioned earlier about a paper shortage. They are having trouble with the contractors providing the standards of the paper that they're using in this. Another interesting thing that we learned, as I understand it, two of the major cigarette companies worked together on the formulation and the standards, and it turns out one of the large companies, there's some question about whether they're meeting the standards set that they helped work on in New York. So they've either got to change the standard or change their formulation, as I understand it. This only underscores that this hasn't been figured out yet, and that's really my message today. I'd like for this to all be figured out before we roll into something that that isn't completely analyzed. What I would like to talk about is why Oregon should not take these immediate steps, creating standards and requirements which are different from whatever comes out of national standards and our neighboring states. And my sense is this is going to move forward. In fact, our representative in Washington said that she predicts national standards within 2 years. It's really a practical reason this is going to happen, because Oregon, New York, Maine, a number of Atlantic seaboard states are trying to copy the move that's made in New York, including their formulation and standards. And again, because those standards are in question today, our association and our industry is going to have to look at national standards so that we don't have the kind of situation that Rich and Ryan talked about, especially if we have one formulation and Washington and California have another. So I admire the concept, maybe, but this is one thing that I don't think Oregon should be on the leading edge of. I think we're a relatively small state, cigarette consumption-wise, and there are going to be a lot of people working on this, and my message is let's work with them to get the standards. There are going to be additional costs, but it's not going to be just the cost of the paper. It's going to be logistical. How do you separate? And not to repeat what the fellow from Rich and Ryan said, but Washington's going to have going to be different than Oregon and the other states as well. So there's costs in managing these different formulations. It's a different product. These costs are going to be passed along to retailers such as Plaid Pantry and our neighborhood store members, and ultimately to the Oregon consumers. I don't know how much it's going to be, but it's going to be something more than what it is now. It's unquantifiable. It's an unknown, and the unknown scares us. But there's another factor that I'd like for you to consider, and that is, how is it going to affect the state of Oregon? As I said, Oregon's a relatively small consumer of cigarettes compared to neighboring states and national totals. We're already experiencing a large decrease in legally purchased tobacco products. In other words, the sales that the state of Oregon collects taxes on. And that's due, different topic, but the succession of large increases in excise taxes. In the graph that I hope is distributed by now, you'll see that we've gone from about 28 million legally purchased cartons to under 20 million for 2005. That's an estimate. It actually took a bounce down to about 18 million. Now, these aren't cartons smoked by Oregonians. These are legally purchased cartons. The little bounce up in 2005, our people in marketing model this stuff all the time because it's a big product category for us. The little bit of a bump up is the sunset of the 10-cent tax, the dollar carton, last year. And also, we got a little bit ahead of Washington. Washington raised their taxes, and so the cross-border factor came back a little bit. But the fact is, nationally, sales are going down about 2.5%, 3% consumption. Oregon is trailing down, as you'll see in the graph, more like 5 or 6%. These are not Oregonians. I'm sorry, Senator Burdick left. These are not Oregonians quitting smoking. Consumption is actually flattened out, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view. But what's happening is people are buying their products someplace else and they're not paying Oregon tax on it. From our analysis, we know that we're missing 2 million cartons. In other words, there's 2 million cartons being smoked in Oregon that nobody's paying tax on. This comes from people purchasing on the internet, Native American smoke shops, cross-border shopping, and just plain bootleg black gray market sources. We also see from history that incremental cost increases, whether it's taxes or legislative regulatory mandates, as we're talking about today, are going to drive further illegal sales out of the system. And again, that's a separate topic, but Oregon really needs to fix this, and I know the Department of Justice and Department of Revenue is working on it, but it's not fixed yet. It's regulating a sieve. It's thousands upon thousands of individual people at 800 numbers and internet sites and their neighbor going over to wherever they go, Idaho, to get lower tax product or getting it shipped in from a friend in North Carolina. But the 2 million missing cartons is huge. I mean, it's $25 million that we're missing. But there's other pieces of that too, the master settlement agreement payments from the tobacco companies. The cartons are down, and we're losing, we're not getting the revenue that we projected we were going to get because of this leakage in untaxed product. So these lost sales hurt not only legitimate legal tax-paying, tax-collecting retailers such as Plaid Pantry and our ANZA members, but it also hurts Oregon revenue. An Oregon retailer grosses an average of about 50 cents for every pack of cigarettes we sell. All in, excise, MSA, income tax on retailers such as Plaid, the state of Oregon collects $1.60 for every pack sold. So you're more in the tobacco business than I am. I don't mean that as a negative thing, but it's a huge revenue number to the state. We're very worried about it because of the decline that we're seeing. So, for example, if this boutique formulation, if it turns out to be that for Oregon, which is different, obviously, than Washington or California, which doesn't do it yet, we don't know if the New York formulation is going to be the final formulation. All these other states are looking at it. Let's say it costs the 10 cent a pack that sunsetted, a nominal amount. That's $5 million for Oregon retailers, but it's $16 million to the state of Oregon. And I'm saying going on the leading edge, trying to formulate a laudable goal is real risky for my constituents and for the state of Oregon on taxes. I urge you not to take the lead in this. I think we should be involved in it. Our national association is involved in it. You certainly got our attention with this legislation, and it's not unnoticed in Washington. That was part of my call today. This is going on. There's a movement with us now, and whatever the standards turn out to be, they should be uniform to eliminate the problems short-term and long-term for different states with different standards. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I really appreciate the time letting me speak today.
Mr. York, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and take Dan's testimony, then we'll open it up with questions.
Okay.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Dan Floyd, and I know that my testimony may sound like an echo now after Mr. Girard, so I will be brief for you. From the Oregon Grocery Association, we have 235 members, 1,113 member locations, and over we employ over 50,000 Oregonians. These members are involved in manufacturing, wholesaling, and retailing of grocery products. Obviously, I'm here today in opposition of the two bills, Senate Bill 738 and Senate Bill 931. I am not here, like Mr. Girard, to suggest that fire-safe cigarettes are inadequate or not good, but I'm here to suggest that a national uniform standard will help to address some of the unintended consequences that may arise from a statewide standard. I will quickly move through three points that I wanted to hit on. The first one is a statewide standard would create segregated inventory, receiving systems, order pulling systems, and delivery systems for both manufacturers and distributors. This ultimately drives up the cost for the consumer, and I know that you guys may be thinking, well, boo-hoo, but number two is where that matters to you. Driving up the cost to the consumer may push them to buy the cigarettes off the internet or via the internet or via these 800 numbers that we've heard about today. Anytime this happens, obviously these consumers are avoiding paying our state's tobacco taxes. And I heard on the video there's one gentleman who mentioned that if people do not like the cigarettes, that they may switch brands. I believe they're not going to switch brands. They're going to switch states, not by moving, but via the internet. They will just buy their tobacco somewhere else. Once again, avoiding the state income, tobacco tax. Finally, ultimately, this creates a disincentive for the suppliers and retailers to even be in the business of selling tobacco. As you've heard, they are how we operate on a slim to none on the profit margin, and some of them even lose money. So if they get out of business, like I've said, that's decreased revenue and tobacco taxes for you. This can all be avoided by a national uniform standard. All the things that you've heard today from the opposition before me and the 3 points that I've outlined, I will not go any further. You've heard enough, I think. Once again, OGA opposes Senate Bill 738 and 931. We urge you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Questions?
Just one short question.
Senator, what's that bill right ahead?
Senator Kozlowski, this, as I understood your testimony, this proposed legislation, the timing of it, if nothing else, would create a competitive disadvantage for you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's right, and a competitive disadvantage to Oregon. The border, especially between Washington, is very fluid. And so, yes, definite short-term problem.
Any other questions? All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. That's all I have on the list of people who had signed up that wanted to give testimony on either of these two bills. We're going to have based on what we thought was going to be the inability to maybe have everyone here, we have set another date for March 15th, if I'm not mistaken, that we will probably have additional testimony. It may be exclusively invited testimony. So those who are here that may want to bring something forward, feel free to contact our administrator, Ms. Braun, and she will have that information. And what we'll do is it will be set for, at that point, possible public hearing as well as a possible work session at this point. So unless there's anything else from anyone that's here today regarding these two bills, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 738 and 931. And do we have anything else we need to take care of? And I thank everyone for being here and being patient with this. We'll go ahead and close today's Senate Commerce Committee.